Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, the Fed did cut its rate by 0.5%. Can you give us any historical background to this, how it affects the economy and so on?
Yeah, they finally did it. Thank goodness, because the rest of the world has started cutting. Obviously, there's been several cuts already in 2024, and there was a lot of concern that the Fed was behind the curve. And indeed, they basically admitted that yesterday. You know, they made the first cut since March of 2020, but they went 50 basis points, which is, you know, arguably the cut they should have made in July, and the one that they're making this month put together. And they acknowledged that, you know, inflation had come down significantly, but that the labor market was showing some signs of concern. And he said in Jackson Hole, Powell did in his speech, that he didn't want to see, last month, he said he didn't want to see any further weakness in the employment market. And that's in fact continuing to happen with downward revisions to the jobs numbers, and also August saw the highest layoffs and the least new hires that we've seen in a long time. So there's definitely evidence of spreading weakness. So the thing is that it's very typical, as I've been writing for some time, for stock markets to have this Pavlovian response when the Fed cuts, and this sort of party-hardy atmosphere where they think, you know, oh great, they're cutting, all is well, all will be saved. But the reality is that when they're doing it, it very much depends why they're cutting, right? And if they're cutting because you've had this upward move in the unemployment rate. And one of the things that was very interesting yesterday, I think it was a New York Times reporter asked Powell, you know, you're saying that the economy is strong, that things are good, but you're cutting by 50 basis points, which is something they've only done basically four times in the last many years, and each of those times was, you know, the sort of 2001, 2008, 2020. So those were all in response to major recessions unfolding and major bear markets that happened, and the unemployment rate continued to spike for many, many months after they started the rate cut cycle. So, you know, the reporter was asking him, how can you say things are good and that the unemployment rate won't rise from here, when in reality, every cycle, once you start cutting, the unemployment rate rises? And he never answered that, right? He just skirted around that. So the things that really matter is, you know, the level of valuation for assets as you're coming into the cutting cycle, and we're at all-time highs historically, the worst ever in terms of the equity market in history, really, vying for the 2000 tech top mania stuff. Also, the level of debt is the highest ever, and the level of employment was at rock bottom, at all-time highs. The unemployment rate was at rock bottom lows, so we had a very high employment. That was very cyclical, Jim, you know, in the economy. So the fact that you've got a very low unemployment rate in the pause portion when the Fed stopped cutting and you've got this very low unemployment rate, that's always foreboding, because we know that it's a cycle that continues to rise, as I said. So when you look at all that together, You know, they we saw the first cut in September of 2007. The S&P and they did, as I said, 50 basis points at that point, and the S&P gained, you know, strongly that day when Bernanke did that, and then again in October of 2008 when he cut by 50 basis points, you saw almost a 3% gain in the S&P that day, but the stock market still went on to lose about 50%. So whenever you've got these conditions of the, you know, galloping unemployment starting to rise, extraordinarily high valuations, too much optimism coming into the cutting cycle, you typically have these knee-jerk reactions of euphoria in asset markets, and then you've got the reality check, which is, oh God, they're cutting by 50 basis points because things are looking pretty rough. And we also have to remember that things like oil, as an example, today, as the stock market's popped, now the S&P is only up about 1.8% today. That's pretty mild, really. It was off yesterday when he actually made the announcement. So it's pretty mild relative to some of the historical precedents we've seen. But the oil price today is around 72. It's the same level as when they were paused in July of 2023. So there's no big demand surge evident. You know, the spending data that we get out of the retail sector was really weak. So there's just a lot of, like I said, euphoric trading around this idea that the Fed's coming to the rescue, that they're going to prevent anything bad from happening, and there's just no real precedent for that. So I think we have to be quite sober. Also, the bond market is selling off a bit today. I think there's a couple of concerns there. I think that the bond market is looking ahead and saying, okay, you know, are they going to slash really aggressively? Are they going back to sub 2%? It won't fix anything in the near run, but in the longer run, that could re-stimulate excessive demand in the economy. That could re-stimulate more housing speculation, for example, which is the exact opposite of what we need at this stage. And I also think that the bond market's looking ahead to the election in November and saying, you know, at this stage, no matter who wins, they're likely to spend a ton. Now, it won't probably start until, you know, after the new government is sworn in January. But if we are in a recessionary period here and the economy continues to deteriorate over the next several months and the Fed is slashing rates and the asset prices are falling, you could very well see a lot of pressure to start handing out checks to people again. You know, MM2, the monetary market money program on steroids again. If that happened, then I think we could see a resurgence of inflation, and I think that would be pretty awful all around as well. So we're, you know, I'm not at all impressed with the rebound in stocks, say, in the sense of that being a bullish sign. I think it's typical behavior. I remain skeptical, and I do think that the Fed did the right thing in cutting because they're behind the ball in terms of the deteriorating labor market.
In Canada, the federal government has proposed new mortgage rules. What are those changes, and what are the likely effects?
Yeah, so this is more of the same. This is the same craziness. You know, they're making it out as if they help people to borrow more money, that's somehow helping them. You know, so first-time home buyers and all buyers of new builds. This is, the builders have lobbied for this, right? Because sales have been falling and they're very concerned about, you know, making ends meet in this environment. So they've been lobbying the government to step in and help. The lenders have been lobbying the government to say, you know, we need you to take on more of the bank risk, because the growth in all the loan growth in the chartered banks since 2017 was in uninsured mortgages that CMHC didn't cover. And so the banks are now sitting there with a lot of credit risk, and they're watching asset prices fall. They're watching the economy and the unemployment rate, the economy deteriorate and the employment deteriorate, and they're saying, you know, you better help us here. So sure enough, they roll out this plan that's going to extend the amortization, wouldn't start till December 15, but they propose extending amortizations to 30-year mortgages. Well, I'm having deja vu, Jim. We did this back in 2008 briefly. They went to a 40-year amortization potential, following the U.S. in that, because the U.S. had all these crazy, you know, easy credit conditions, which billowed their housing bust into 2007. And that was what brought on the Great Recession, of course, was the crumbling housing market and all the sketchy debt that had been written against it. And back then, the Canadian government, you know, did that in a response to follow the leader, so to speak. But then as they watched all hell breaking loose, they walked it back. So now here we are, we're, you know, that many years, 17 years later, and here we are going for this idea of extending the amortization and also allowing CMHC to underwrite. So this is the government-backed, you know, mortgage insurance, to back properties up to $1.5 million from what had been $1 million of limit. So the net effect of this is that, you know, can you imagine, like, just consider this math. Say a property is $1.2 million and someone doesn't have a 20% down payment. They've only got 10% down. So they're putting 120 down. They're borrowing, you know, more than $1.80 million. As a mortgage, mind-blowing, at current rates, they have to pay, in addition to that, a 3.1% CMHC fee if they're going to avail themselves of this government backing for the mortgage, because you don't have 20% down. All that together, at current rates of 4.6, your mortgage payments are going to be like $6,600 a month. And I mean, if you do the math on that, you know, a rule of thumb is that 32% of your gross household income shouldn't be more than 32% that goes to mortgage principal, interest, taxes, and heat. Well, all that in there, you're looking at sort of, you know, more than about $7,000 a month in payments. Well, it turns out to keep in line with the 32% of gross house monthly income, you're going to need to make over $260,000 a year. So, you know, who's borrowing this? Like, there's only 300 or so thousand households in Canada that make over $250,000 a year. And this is supposed to help first-time home buyers? Like, it's absolutely bonkers. All it's trying to do is boost up the asset values of existing homeowners, which has been the Trudeau playbook. You know, the government has made this mistake repeatedly through the last few years of insisting that, you know, trying to suck and blow, trying to say, well, you know, homes are a big retirement asset in Canada, so we can't let values go down. Well, they're actually not a retirement asset. They're a place to live. They're a shelter. They're a fundamental component of what you need to have productivity in a society, is have a roof over one's head, right? But not these incredibly overpriced properties that no one can afford. And the other awful thing that's going to flow from that is anyone who does avail themselves of these extended amortizations, it just means they're going to pay, you know, like 26% more interest over 30 years than if they'd borrowed over 25 years. They're going to owe more at the end of the term than they would have. And they're going to have a, you know, this idea that shaving a couple of $100 off monthly is helping anybody is just a terrible misjudgment. So I'm not very impressed with it, obviously.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, what would a balance sheet recession look like, and what would it mean for the broader economy?
Yes, so balance sheet recession is a term that was coined from when the Japanese asset bubbles burst in the late 1980s. And it's when things that people have levered against, so primarily housing, real estate, that's the biggest asset class in the world, and it's the most levered asset class in the world, but also the stock market. People borrow a lot against, you know, financial assets as well. And so if you're, you know, if you're borrowing and those asset values are going up, there's a case to be made for that behavior. When the asset values start to fall, this is where all hell breaks loose, right? So what we saw in the Japanese implosion was the values dropped by, you know, 90% in some cases, just like in 1929 when the stock market fell that much. And what happens is that there's no collateral then, right? So there's a whole bunch of borrowing, lending that is revealed as being imprudent, that should never have been lent, and there's no scope for paying it back because the assets are just a fraction of pennies on the dollar of what's been borrowed. So that was what happened in Japan. It's what's happening right now in China. And then what happens, just to finish the thought on Japan, is that it took many, many, many years for those asset values to regain the prior peak. And at that point, you know, there's been a whole bunch of write-offs had to happen in terms of the lenders and in terms of writing down the value of things. And it's a long lethargic cleaning out period where the economy typically goes sideways and the asset prices go sideways and you just don't get that leverage boost under the economy. So the same thing has happened in China because their stock market burst initially after it peaked in this 2007 mania. Then it, you know, it tried to recover a couple of times, but it has continued to have short rallies to lower lows. And it really wiped out the appetite of Chinese investors who thought they were, you know, their household income was insufficient to cover all their needs, let them save for retirement and health care, as well as provide, you know, buy a house, et cetera. So they did things like borrowing to speculate. They did that originally in the stock market. Then they, when that didn't work, they moved to the housing market, and that's how the you know, the Chinese government tried to stimulate the economy after the 2008 debacle. They helped pull the world out of the global financial crisis by borrowing and spending a ton on capital spending in terms of the property sector, real estate. Well, they got to the point where it too became obscenely levered, and that has been imploding now for the past 4 years. So we've got a bunch of developers going bankrupt. We've got a bunch of people who bought these properties, condos and apartments and things. They couldn't afford to live in them. They only bought them because they thought they were going to go up in price. Well, now that they've been falling in price for the past 4 years, you know, there's a lot of social unrest and disappointment and people not able to pay back money that's been borrowed and all that. So that was happening in China, and I just use it as a frame of concern because a similar thing happened in 2006-07, of course, in the U.S. economy when housing became so inflated relative to household income and rates, and it became highly levered, too much debt, et cetera, all these sketchy credit products. And then you saw that the price bubble burst. All the debts became revealed as, you know, insolvent, couldn't be repaid. And then the banks have to go through this big write-down period, and then the governments are looked to bail them out and all this sort of thing. So that happened after the 2008 debacle in the United States. And it's happened in Canada, frankly. I'm concerned that, of course, as you know, our housing market, our property cycle went to obscene levels, like much higher than most countries in the world, again, relative to income and rents and historic norms. And you know, the average appreciation rate for properties, most people don't understand this, is roughly in line with the rate of inflation over time, is that, you know, that real estate typically over very long periods goes up by a couple or 3% a year. Well, in Canada, it was appreciating at more than 5% a year there for several years. So what that really tells you is that's how we got to this mess where, you know, in many of the major cities where people are trying to live, it's just completely impossible to own a place to live. And rents have also been on this really incredible trajectory higher, and it's made it impossible for people to afford as well. Well, at some point you hit the end of what's capable of being borrowed or manufactured in order to pay rents even, and people consolidate households, they move back in with relatives, they put things up for sale. And we're seeing that in terms of galloping inventories all over in America as well as in Canada this time. But the sales are not happening, right? The sales levels are very low, the lowest in 40 years in some cases. You know, the inventory in places like the Greater Toronto Area, where, let's not forget, the bulk of the largest portion of Canadian population lives in that Greater Toronto Area, and you've got 14 months now of supply of housing just sitting there because people just can't afford to buy it. So the August resale price was $649,000, and that's down from about $815,000 at the peak of the bubble a couple of years ago. So prices are definitely coming down, but when you look at the amount of new, you know, new home sales in the GTA were negative 46 year over year in August. August is usually a pretty good month for sales, and we're down by almost 50%. Condo sales were down 61%, single family homes 14%, and as I say, you've got this more than 14 months of inventory. Now, that's not in every city, but if you look at them, even Calgary is seeing this increasing inventory. You know, for a while there, it was relatively less expensive to live in Calgary. And now we're also seeing, you know, this pressure building in terms of not enough sales to absorb the amount of listings that are coming on the market. This is kind of classic balance sheet recession stuff, because people are having to sell properties now for steep discounts relative to where they purchased them or levered them, you know, increased refi, that sort of thing, back when rates were at all-time lows. So even though the central banks have started cutting rates here, and even though, you know, we had the longest yield curve inversion in terms of the rate structure since 1929 coming into this, and we had the longest central bank pause in terms of the U.S. Fed for 15 months from in this time before they started the cutting cycle. They did the same thing in the 2006-2007 cycle, and all that is just really to say that an incredible amount of credit risk is built up in this system against this asset class, which has gone up too much and is now in the deflationary part of the cycle. So as that happens, people are going to realize that they're left with the debt and the equity values are dropping on balance sheets. And that's what that means, right? The one side, the asset values are falling, but the debt's still sitting there and in many cases been getting higher because they're not paying, you know, the full principal and interest payments. And we had all those crazy hybrid mortgages where people were just paying interest and not even all the interest. So really what it tells you is that you're in for a tough slog. You know, it in the past episodes of that, it's typical for home prices to fall, like in Canadian home prices in the 1989, which was the last sort of really crazy bubble peak we had before this one in terms of overzealous activity going on in real estate. Prices fell then from 1989 through 96 in most markets. They were down about 34%. The thing is, it takes years for them to recover, right? They were basically flat then all the way to about the fourth quarter. On a real basis, national prices in Canada did not revisit the 89 high until the fourth quarter of 2003. So that's about 15 years of flatness. So I remember that very well because I was just sort of entering the housing market back in 1990, and I remember that prices really had come off, and then they didn't really go anywhere for a number of years. So people got on with other more productive activities in the economy besides trying to be land barons and speculate on housing. And it was much more healthy for the economy, where people saw houses as houses instead of, you know, retirement accounts. So I think that we're likely to see the downturn continue, the inventories build. We've had something like 25 builders have gone bankrupt in Canada in 2024. So that's all part and parcel of this reality. And you get a massive kind of just consolidation in that whole sector. So I think that will probably go on for a period of years, not months. As I said, the unemployment rate will probably continue to rise for many months while the central banks are cutting. And, you know, the most important thing to realize is, yes, it's typical for the stock market to rally on the news of these big cuts. But in every case, when you had valuations something like the present level and you go like all-time highs and you go into a recession, the stock market has fallen, you know, between 35 and 55% over the preceding 12 to 24 months. And so just try and imagine if we've got a housing market that's, you know, continuing to fall in value for people, which is great for those looking to buy, but for the balance sheets that are recording those values as against the debts they've borrowed against them, if you've got a housing market coming down values as well as a stock market doing its bear market thing, which is, by the way, the most typical and traditional thing. Actually, every single time that the Fed has been cutting into a recession, you get the stock market selling off like that. You know, we've only had the M2 stock of money is lower now than in 2022. You've only had four other contractions in M2 since the 20s. And all of them were deep recessions, and indeed, of course, 29 to 33 was the depression. So it's just to say that there's a lot of reasons for concern and caution here, and the people that are sitting there with a lot of leverage against these asset prices thinking they can only go up are likely to be very disappointed.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Counsel, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Find us on X at How Street. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.